Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 150,000, that's the estimated number of undocumented immigrants living in Massachusetts, according to the American Immigration Council, though as we know, that could be an undercount. Because of their status, they're unable to work in the state legally, but they still have to pay bills.
A lot of people do their best to just find day labor and work as they can for people that are willing to give them work.
And that tension can make them vulnerable.
Federal investigators say these men smuggled people from Brazil into the U.S., had them work in their restaurants, and often kept their wages to pay off the smuggling debt.
Federal investigators say the owner threatened undocumented migrants to work against their will, underpaid them, and even attacked them.
This type of abuse, not new. Undocumented workers can face an impossible choice: put up with abuse, stay under the radar, or speak up and face retaliation.
Flores says he never wanted anything more than to be paid for his work.
La preocupación mía es mi familia. Primero que nada, mi familia.
My concern was for my family, Flores says.
In the end, advocates call it a vicious cycle, one that impacts those who are undocumented and documented.
Ultimately, that undermines the working conditions of all workers because there's this major portion of the workforce that will put up with pretty much anything.
That was immigration attorney Rachel Self. Sound from CBS Boston on investigations in Woburn and in Boston with Stash's Pizza, former WBUR immigration reporter Shannon Dooling, and Diego Lowe with the Metro West Worker Center. So, what creates the conditions that allows these situations and abuse to unfold, and what can we do to stop it? Today, that's how we are diving beneath the headlines. And with us for the journey, Shannon Dooling, an investigative reporter in Boston, formerly at WBUR, and also an associate professor of journalism at Boston University. Shannon Liss Reardon, Boston labor attorney and former candidate for Massachusetts Attorney General. And Gladys Vega, executive director of La Collaborativa. Shannon Dooling, welcome.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
Shannon Liss Reardon, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Gladys Vega, thanks to you too.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And I just give me a second to do a little more setup for the listeners. This is why we are talking about this today. There are two cases in Woburn, owners of two Woburn restaurants, federally charged with smuggling Brazilian immigrants into the U.S. and forcing them to work long hours by threatening them with harm. Part of the scheme was allegedly recruiting these immigrants from their home countries with promises of a better life in the U.S. In Boston, owner of a pizza parlor chain, Stash's, charged with forced labor, stands accused of forcing undocumented workers to work long hours and verbal and, in at least one case, physical abuse. Shannon Dooling, these are recent cases, but this type of abuse, not new, correct?
Not new at all. You know, the headlines, we're seeing them a little more frequently as of late in the last few months, but the tape that you played in the intro, that's from a report that I filed in 2019. And so, yeah, this is kind of a classic intimidation case, right? The employers in these situations yield incredible amounts of power. Oftentimes, folks in these communities are leaving desperate, if not dangerous, situations in their home countries. They want to come to this country to provide for their families. They think that they are doing so in a way that, at least by their employer, sometimes is told, you know, it's okay, you can come this way, you know, we'll work it out. And then they get here, and it's a very different story.
And Attorney Shannon Liss Reardon, do we know, are we in a climate where this is actually happening more?
I mean, this has been happening forever. I've been doing cases involving this type of exploitation for more than 20 years. I think we're hearing about it more recently. Rachel Rollins is taking a stand, which is a great thing. It's hard for these workers to come forward. They have rights, regardless of whether or not they have documentation here. If they're doing work, they need to be paid for it. The law protects them, and they can't be abused in this way. But it's so hard for them to step forward because their employers hold this huge thing over them, that if they speak out, they're going to drop a dime on them with immigration authorities. And that makes people very afraid to come forward.
Gladys Vega, I'm struck by Shannon Liss Reardon saying there Rachel Rollins is being aggressive with these cases. What are you hearing from the community in Chelsea in reaction to these prosecutions?
So I think the prosecutions and the role that Rachel Rollins, our U.S. attorney, has taken, it's admirable. It is not enough. This has happened for decades. I remember vividly working on the Boston Heisenberg case. That was another case of human trafficking right on Eastern Avenue. And there were workers that had to pay their coyotes. There were workers that were working in horrible conditions. There were workers that were forced to hide when the U.S. Department of Labor came to inspect the building to hear the comments that we were recording with the employees. So those things continue to happen in our community. And because they hold the power of their money, at times they provide housing for them too. They know that they're undocumented, so they always play that immigration card. If you don't listen to me, I'm going to call immigration. I know that you have family in El Salvador, in Honduras. So all those things are real, and that is why sometimes people are not willing to come forward. And it's so important for us to continue to do outreach efforts in order for us to stabilize our community in terms of letting them know that they have rights, that regardless of documented or undocumented, that in United States, the dignity of the worker, it's seen, and there's rights to protect them.
So we're talking about the ability of employers to be coercive with undocumented workers. What spurred this are these cases in Woburn and Boston. I'm speaking with Shannon Dooling, Shannon Liss Reardon, Gladys Vega. Shannon Dooling, I'll come back to you. Gladys Vega talked about having to pay coyotes, people having access to families back home and threatening families back home, threatening to go to ICE. There's a lot of power of coercion here.
Yeah.
You know, you talked about the reporting on Jose Flores. In that case, he wanted to file a workers' comp, and his employer threatened to go to ICE.
Well, so yeah, what happened is he did file a workers' compensation claim, which, as Shannon Liss Reardon, pointed out, is totally within his legal rights to do so in Massachusetts. He fell from a ladder, had a really bad fall, broke his femur bone, was unable to work, the sole provider in his family, didn't have legal documentation in the country, consulted with some attorneys, filed the workers' compensation claim. A few weeks later, the owner of Terra Construction, the company he was working for, set up an appointment, said, hey, I want to give you some cash to help you get through these tough times until your workers' compensation claim comes through. Paz Flores showed up for that appointment, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement were a couple blocks down the street and arrested him right after he left that. Fast forward a few years, and the Department of Labor actually filed a lawsuit. This was under President Trump, former President Trump. His Department of Labor filed a lawsuit against Terra Construction, claiming that they retaliated against Paz Flores for having filed that workers' compensation claim. And recently, last year, a jury actually sided with Paz Flores in that argument. So, you know, perhaps that's, you know, a precedent to have been set in federal court. It does strike me that all of these charges are brought at the federal level. I know that Massachusetts has anti-trafficking laws on the books as a state, but we do see that, you know, it rises to the level of federal prosecution. That's an interesting thing to note.
So, Shannon Liss Reardon, that's where I want to go with you, right? Because, you know, you noted this is U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins for the state of Massachusetts who's prosecuting in these two cases. Gladys Vega noting the power of coercion that these employers have. What are the state-level protections from retaliation, from abuse, from hostile work environment, et cetera, that undocumented workers have? And I will note, there will be listeners saying, these workers are undocumented. They are not working legally. Why do they, should they have rights to such protections? So let me give you that whole package of questions to respond to.
So under Massachusetts state law, they have all the same protections that all workers have. If they do work, they have the right to be paid for it. If they work overtime, they need to be paid overtime. They need to be paid at least minimum wage. There are certain areas they need to be paid prevailing wage. So It is incredibly important that these rights be enforced for them, because if they're not, then employers are going to have a real incentive, which unfortunately they already do, to hire undocumented workers because they think they can take advantage of them and they won't speak out when they don't follow all of the rules. So I've been very proud to represent immigrant workers in so many cases, brave workers who have come forward and have set examples exactly like the ones that we're seeing in the news right now. And when they do that, it gives strength to other workers that they know that they can come forward as well. State has power also. State Attorney General's office can bring these cases, and they have criminal enforcement power too. I think it's really important that the employers who repeatedly engage in this kind of behavior, they need to be gone after, so that other employers know they can't get away with this, and they think they have this vulnerable workforce that they can do anything to. I mean, I've seen it in so many industries, the restaurant industry, the cleaning industry, the adult entertainment industry. We see a lot of it. Unfortunately, people don't always understand that you have the same right to be paid, to have a workplace that is safe and free from harassment and physical abuse, whatever your immigration documentation status is.
So I'll turn to you now, Gladys Vega, and there are two questions on my mind based on what we've been hearing. The first is, and yet we have this disconnect where workers remain vulnerable, where we're hearing cases of workplace abuse, where we have two prosecutions going on. And as you read the stories and you hear the stories, what you keep hearing is, this isn't new, this isn't surprising, this is the tip of the iceberg. Why the disconnect?
I think the disconnect is because I think this type of behavior, such as human trafficking, it's like modern-day slavery, and we have learned to normalize it. And until we take it up on our own to make sure that we go to the restaurants, to the construction workers' sites, that the worker centers organize and people in our community are aware of it, and that you go to the bars and you see people working there and you wonder, why is that young girl dressed that way, etc.? Could she be a victim of human trafficking? Once we stop, asking those questions, we are normalizing that behavior and we are not making an impact. And I really think that that's where we need to really put effort in educating the public about labor and sex trafficking, because if we don't expose it in Massachusetts, we'll continue to make it as part of our furniture and it will continue to happen. And for those people that think they're undocumented, they don't deserve any rights, they don't deserve any less, this is about civil rights. This is about human dignity. This is about us thinking, where were our ancestors if they were set in this setup that we are facing, in this past decade? Let's think about humanity and why is it important for us to protect each other.
So you actually answered the second question I was going to ask with that as well, which is excellent. So I will turn to Shannon Liss Reardon now. What can the legal community in Massachusetts be doing better, Shannon?
Well, there are lots of worker centers out there. There are lots of advocates who are doing really great work trying to communicate to communities that they have these rights and that there are resources that can help them. Private lawyers can take these cases. People can go to the Attorney General's office. People can go to Greater Boston Legal Services. I think these are very important cases. And when they come along, we look at them very closely. And it's a lot of work to encourage these workers to recognize they have rights, and that they're setting an example for others if they push forward and stand up for their rights. And also for people who are particularly concerned about immigration repercussions, the Department of Labor does have a program where workers can get a certain amount of status that protects them for at least a period of time while a case is being investigated. So it's not what everyone is looking for, but it's some degree of protection. when there are these abuses and people are willing to come forward. We need to be encouraging them to come forward, and we need to be making an example of those bad employers who are thinking that they can get away with abusing workers who have this vulnerability.
And Shannon Dooling.
Yeah, on that note, about making examples of employers who are practicing these, exhibiting these practices, you know, historically, we often have seen headlines that have focused on, you know, dozens of undocumented immigrants arrested at a plant or at a you know, Gladys spoke about some of that work that was done here in East Boston and in Chelsea years ago, sort of quote unquote raids of workplace violations. You know, the folks who are often featured in those headlines are the immigrant workers, not the employers, not the owners of the companies. And you often, you know, you often, even on Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE's website, you see, you know, several undocumented immigrants, unauthorized workers found at X place. You don't hear about the name of the employer. You don't hear about the fallout for the employer. And so I think what these federal prosecutions are kind of showing us is that, you know, at least here in Massachusetts, Rachel Rollins, U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins, is trying to sort of flip that dynamic on its head and really highlight the employer and show their misgivings and their wrongdoings as opposed to the unauthorized worker, you know, being a part of that.
All right. Shannon Dooling is an investigative reporter in Boston, formerly at WBUR, and an associate professor of journalism at Boston University. Shannon Liss Reardon, Boston labor attorney, former candidate for Massachusetts Attorney General, and Gladys Vega, executive director at La Collaborativa. Thanks to all three of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The opioid crisis continues to grow. More than 2,000 people died of opioid-related overdoses in Massachusetts in 2021, according to the State Department of Health, and the fallout is devastating. With each death, families are left picking up the pieces, families and loved ones, and that can include basic financial pieces, like the costs to pay for burials, funerals, even body removal. In Massachusetts, advocates want the state to help. State and private institutions, in much the same way that we do for families of homicide victims. That is the subject of an op-ed published yesterday in the Boston Globe by two of our guests. Elsa Gomes-Bondlow is the CEO and co-founder of the Social Equity Access Fund, and Brendan Little serves on the state's Opioid Recovery and Remediation Fund Advisory Council, previously served as policy director for the City of Boston's Recovery Services under former Mayor Marty Walsh. Also joining us here in the studio, Joanne Peterson, executive director and founder of Learn to Cope, a Massachusetts nonprofit devoted to helping families with loved ones struggling with addiction. We're going to explore this, and I want to warn listeners, we are talking about a difficult subject here, and the content may be challenging. Brendan, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Elsa, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Joanne, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Brendan, Elsa, I'm going to start with you. Brendan, why this op-ed?
Well, Elsa and I got together. We got connected through mutual friends and started to help people who needed support with burying their loved one after an overdose. And then quickly, we just kind of became the people that people would come to. And we've done a few of them over the last few years. And mostly through my social connections in the substance use recovery world and then through Elsa's foundation, we've been able to accommodate these families. And, you know, we're all pretty well connected and we know people in government and in philanthropic circles. And we keep bringing up this issue. And people are compassionate. They care about it. But they're always just kind of like, oh, that's so sad. And then that's kind of it. And previously, I worked in violence prevention space as a young adult, and I knew very much of this whole infrastructure with, you know, that supports victims of violence through the state, through philanthropic circles. So we're really trying to borrow from that, not compete, but just expand that circle outwards so that we can better support these families, especially since there's been so many overdoses over the last few years as compared to homicides. For every one homicide, there's been 14.5 overdoses.
So, Elsa, help us understand what kinds of financial cost is a family facing? And again, It is hard to talk about money when we are talking about loss and grief. And yet that is the moment we're in, and that is the conversation we're having today. What kind of financial burden is a family facing when they have to bury a family member who has died of an overdose?
I think it depends on what the family chooses to do. And of course, when people have no choice because they have no resources, they'll do anything. They just want to see their family, a loved one, buried, which everybody deserves that dignity and respect at the end of their lives, especially people that have already been marginalized and are already in a hard situation. And so the costs that I've been able to support through the Social Equity Access Fund range from maybe $2,000 to sometimes up to $5,000. But again, we should not be putting numbers on an issue that we've, from the beginning of times, we've had people die. We all are going to die one day. And the idea is we should all, as a society, feel that people deserve to be buried with dignity and respect. And then figure it out, what are the solutions that we can provide as state, as philanthropy, as society, as brothers and sisters in this world, that then we should figure out what the cost is.
So, Joanne, I'm going to bring you in here. You began Learn to Cope back in 2004.
Yes.
For a very personal reason.
Yes.
Would you be willing to share that story?
Well, yes. There's been substance use disorder and mental health use disorder but mental health disparity in my family for many years. And I did start Learn to Cope in 2004 when I had a family member struggling. I've lost a brother, and I just lost a niece in 2018 to a fentanyl overdose. And when we talk about the cost to the families, with what we do around the entire state and have been doing for almost 20 years, is supporting that family to survive what they're going through, to get educated. What is treatment? How do you find it? And then, you know, we have people that second mortgage their homes or empty out their 401ks, or they're already at poverty level and they don't have a home or a 401k. And then they're trying to raise a grandchild or a family member and being a caretaker, and they're trying to work and they can't retire. And then that person dies, and then their body is stuck at a medical examiner's and they can't afford to have a funeral home do services for them. So a lot of times people, we know they're struggling already, or they'll reach out. And a lot of our donation funds sadly come from obituaries, because we deal with loss constantly within Learn to Cope. A lot of hope and recovery too, but a lot of loss. Just every month there's loss. Right now there's loss happening within Learn to Cope. So the donation funds that we have, because we don't do a lot of fundraising, we're supported by the state of Massachusetts, DPH, BSAS funds. But the donations we get, sadly, are mainly from obituaries in lieu of flowers. Please donate to Learn to Cope, because we've helped families. But the sad thing is, you see other situations out there, you know, there's walks for treatment, there's, you know, for other diseases, or, you know, there's also memorials and places you can go to lay down a flower or plant a tree for other things, but there isn't for this. And when you lose that person, it's very, you know, people don't know what to say to you or do.
We're talking with Joanne Peterson, Elsa Gomes-Bondlow, and Brendan Little about the need to support families in the moment after losing someone to an overdose. I'm going to pause here for a moment and offer a couple of resources to listeners. I know this is a challenging conversation. The first is, if you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, there is a 24/7 suicide and mental health crisis lifeline that you can text or call. And that number is very simple. It is 988. Again, that number is 988. There is also a federal substance use helpline. It is also available 24/7. And that number is 1-800-662-4357, or help. And I'm going to give that again. It's 1-800-662-4357. That's 662-HELP. So, Brendan, let me turn back to you now. What are you and Elsa proposing?
So what we're proposing is that the state and philanthropic circles consider the ways they could support families with this issue. And one of the ways that people kind of feel fearful about this, or one of the reasons why they're worried, is they want to focus on prevention and treatment. We argue that this is prevention, because for every death, there's a lot of fallout for the people in their lives. Oftentimes children are orphaned, parents lose their children, and those people often also struggle with substance use disorder. So the trauma is exponential and expands out.
I'm going to note that, and you had noted this, something similar to this in the op-ed, at least 47,000 children are impacted by the opioid epidemic in Massachusetts, according to the United Hospital Fund. So you're talking about, you think there are ripple effects here.
Yes.
And this need to provide for burial costs, funereal costs, et cetera, is a practical ripple effect that then leads to additional pain and suffering.
Yes, exactly. And that, I mean, you can ask anybody, including myself, who's in recovery, Joanne, who works with these families all the time. It is a family disease, and oftentimes it has ripple effects down generations. So what we're proposing is there's a once-in-a-lifetime funding coming in through the opioid lawsuits that are coming in. And we think that it would be advantageous for the state as well as for philanthropic groups to come together to figure out a way to vet people who are submitting for funds. We do know that 57% of Americans cannot afford an emergency of $1,000. So, you know, that's crazy. So we need to be able to support people in their time of need, because it demonstrates that their state cares about them and that their community cares about them. So it's one thing to lose a loved one. It's another then to not have the ability or agency to give them a dignified burial. That just is hurt on top of hurt.
So, Elsa, let's grapple together for a minute. You've been in the nonprofit sector for a long time, and the Social Equity Access Fund is an interesting one, founded in 2020 with a sort of a social capital, I trust you, social bonds model of I know this person is in need, we'll give them a voucher, a local business will support them. You know, part of the pushback here will be great. So now we give it to interested nonprofits like the Social Equity Access Fund or, you know, Learn to Cope. They'll take overhead. They'll take money out of it. It will just benefit them. You know, there are those concerns that will be addressed that pushback.
Yes, there's always concerns around what money goes to philanthropy. But sometimes we end up giving money to millionaires and billionaires and never question why we're giving it to them. So I empathize with people that want to know what their funds are going to. But being a fundraiser for 20 years and many organizations in the greater Boston area, a lot of them serving immigrants and refugees, I think organizations that serve the most marginalized are the most questioned about what they spend their money on. And honestly, philanthropy has not been always a friend of or even wanting to change itself to fit more of this type of issues where, you know, not everybody fits in a box. Not everybody fits in the correct box to deserve or to be eligible for certain funding. And so if an emergency happens in your family or if there's a crisis and philanthropy comes in to help, instead of just giving the money to solve the problem, which is what philanthropy is there to do, we ask questions, we ask for a 500-page grant that you don't have time to write and I don't have time to read, and we give you all these barriers and hurdles to go through. So because I had been coming from that world of being a fundraiser, when I became a funder, my biggest priority was give the money, get out of the way, and let people do their work. That is what philanthropy should do. We should be partners with other people. We shouldn't be holier than thou, looking at people down and oh, you know, poor you, let me help you. It should be a partnership. How can I help you? Not just with money. How can I help you with connections? Who can I introduce you to? How can other funders maybe leverage what I gave you? If I don't, like, my fund is not a huge fund, but I can give you a little bit. It's unrestricted. You spend it in whatever you think it's best for you or your organization. And then I let you do your work, or I let you save your family or do whatever it is that you need done.
So, Joanne, there's a lot in what Elsa just said, and there's a piece that I want to draw out, because Brendan and Elsa, in their op-ed in the Boston Globe, pulled this piece out too, which is this concept of deserving. And they went head on to, there are those who will argue that an overdose is a choice and that families should not get help from public sources or private sources when it was a choice. That is a painful conversation. Mm-hmm. But I want to take that piece head on. They took it head on in the op-ed. You take it head on here.
I absolutely can do that. So people look at it as a moral failure, and then the family gets treated, you know, as though they did something wrong. And when somebody actually dies, people will say, well, they were a troubled person. They were a drug addict. And that's so hurtful. Words hurt. Stigma hurts. And what really always bothers our families is, what if you smoked cigarettes for many years and you quit cigarettes and 10 years later you had lung cancer and no one came to the door with, you know, a casserole when you passed away? So what if somebody's in recovery and they have a lapse and then they sadly pass away? No one's at their door. Everyone's looking at it as, oh, that's so sad. He was or she was a drug addict. She wasn't able to mother her child. And you're stigmatized. Your family is stigmatized. It doesn't matter what community you come from. A mother is losing a child. A father is losing a child. A child is losing a parent. And then we're in our second generation of traumatized children that have lost parents. I know children now that are graduating college that their grandmother used to come to our meetings when she was a toddler. She's graduating college. And we continuously have these children that are going through all of this trauma and then growing up with unprocessed grief. And there really isn't any help for them. And philanthropy is the way to go. And it's not that I want to get buckets of money. I would love for the state or the ORF funds. I'm on the commission as well with Brendan. And
the ORF funds being the settlement funds.
The settlement funds. And, you know, we do need to go for treatment and prevention, but what about the victims? What about the families that have lost people? And these children deserve a chance, no matter where they're from, no matter what their background, you know, maybe something for them to go to college later or get some grief therapy and specialized schools having specialized social workers going out into the workforce on how to help these families and how to help these children. And the grandparents and caretakers, you know, there's something about stigma, too, when you're a child of loss and you're amongst your friends and they have two parents or they're being raised by a grandparent and other kids are asking them, where's your parents? So there's you could have 20 shows about this and still not cover it all.
Yeah. I think we're going to stop there. Mm-hmm. We could have 20 shows and still not cover it all, but I appreciate the three of you coming in and helping us start this piece of the conversation. Joanne Peterson is executive director and founder of Learn to Cope, a Massachusetts nonprofit devoted to helping families with loved ones struggling with addiction. Elsa Gomes-Bondlow is CEO and co-founder of the Social Equity Access Fund. And Brendan Little serves on the state's Opioid Recovery and Remediation Fund Advisory Council. Elsa and Brendan had a piece in the Boston Globe yesterday recommending public and private partnerships to support families who have lost people to the opioid crisis in that time of burial and funerals. Thanks to all three of you for being here.
Thank you so much.
That's the Raza String Quartet, performing last month right here at WBUR City Space. The Boston-based ensemble is making a name for itself, exploring, as they put it, the musical world where classical and folk traditions meet. We wanted to know more. Two of the members of the String Quartet joined us in Studio 2 with their instruments to help us explore these musical traditions. Kiyoshi Hayashi, founder and one of the violinists, and Emma Kondo Powell, the ensemble's violist. And I started our conversation by asking Kiyoshi to describe the work of the Raza String Quartet.
Much of the music that we play, as you mentioned, has roots based in different types of folk music, and then usually we take that, and then we're all classically trained musicians. We're a classical string quartet, and we take that and kind of put it into our own genre, so to speak. But I think you could say it's some sort of fusion at times. Genre bending is another word, but like I don't know. I don't really believe in genres. I think it's all just music.
So Emma, was there a point in your musical life and your musical learning when you became exposed to folk music?
I don't know if it was any specific time. I think my first love was classical music, but I've also just been exposed to all different types of music just from living. And so I think what we love to do in this quartet is we love to sort of take all four of our individual musical tastes outside of classical music, and we try to bring those into what we do as a quartet as much as possible.
So let's listen here, Raza String Quartet, WBUR City Space earlier this year. This was an arrangement made by an ethnomusicologist who was Armenian, I think, right? In the sort of late 1800s?
Yeah, his name is Komitas, and he's an Armenian priest and ethnomusicologist. He's sort of known as being one of the pioneers of ethnomusicology.
So. Okay, and this is Rasa String Quartet playing this. Okay, so now I want to put next to it another piece. So that's an Armenian folk singer. And this is an earlier version, right? The sort of the classic version that the arrangement you guys played pulled from.
Absolutely. This is the kind of the earliest sort of field recording, as we like to call it, that we found of this particular arrangement.
A student of his, actually, Komitas.
So I want you to do two things, right? We just heard those two pieces of music next to each other. One, pull a thread of the music that we heard in the original and the music that we hear from the Rasa String Quartet. Teach us a little.
So the tune, I believe it's called Kele Kele. I believe it's a love song of sorts. And he took this melody that was sung all throughout the region, and he wrote it down for the first time. So the second recording that we heard was one of his students singing that song that he had written down and harmonized as a classical piece of music would be written out for the first time.
Let's hear that again for a sec. So literally, this is sung in the villages, right? That, like, you can imagine the bards are going around, and this is what's sung at night when people are by the fire and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think one of the coolest things to think about this old music is that it was often simply just passed down by singing. And so, as Emma said, this was the first time it was actually kind of written out. It was exactly that. It was just passed down generation from generation with people singing across the village to their children, things like that.
So what do you pick up and carry forward in the tradition of the way that the Rasa String Quartet then plays?
Mm-hmm. Sure. The string quartet version that we played, that you just heard, that version was arranged by a cellist, that sort of an Armenian cellist, I believe, that took that first written down version that Komitas had written, and he rearranged it for string quartet specifically, and that's the version that we've played.
Okay, so let's hear that a little more again. So it's really interesting because there's a couple of themes that we've struck on here, and they're going to be interesting to juxtapose to the music that we're going to do next. So let me pull a couple of those out. There's an age to this, right? We're talking about going back and finding, right? We're talking about the cultural tradition of, and we're talking about, I think, an assumption that folk means old, right? And yet another that you've performed, I think, doesn't hit most of those, right? So, and I was fascinated by this. So now we've got Rhiannon Giddens at the Purchaser's Option. It's off her 2017 album, Freedom Highway. I want to listen to a little bit of that.
My fingers bleed to make you rich. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body.
Okay, so I wanted to get all the way to here for a couple of reasons. One, this is 2017, but she is using a piece that she saw that is about the sale of a human being, right? That is offering the option of taking a child with a person in a purchase, which is why it's called At the Purchaser's Option. And we'll unpack all of that in a minute. But what I want to do first is now take the version that, the quartet plays. So all of these concepts of age and history and modern and folk and classical kind of balled up. Just tell me about the choice to use this song, how you thought about it, what your experience has been playing an arrangement of it. Just go.
So this is a song that was Rhiannon Giddens wrote herself, and she herself is this amazing sort of Renaissance woman currently working in the music world. And she is in a old-time string band called the Carolina Chocolate Drops, plays
which is a great name, by
yes.
the way.
And the interesting sort of thread is that she also is an ethnomusicologist. She went to Oberlin. She studied opera. So she's studied classical music, but she really grew up listening to old-time string band music. Is actually very much inspired by Pete Seeger as well. So she grew up listening to all these different types of music, and she said that it wasn't until that she got to college and she started sort of studying the history of the banjo that she learned that the history of the banjo was that it was a Black American art form. She is multiracial, and she grew up sort of in both worlds,
yep.
as she says.
And yep. We've got a little bit of sound from her talking about that part at a TED Talk.
I believe that knowing your history as a musician is super important. It's important as a person. It's important as a country. It's important as a people.
To your point there. Mm-hmm. So now you're playing as Rasa String Quartet. Mm-hmm. Talk about that experience.
I think the very first thing that we all thought about when we decided to program this piece is the immense power of the lyrics and just the weight and gravity of the words that she is singing about. And I remember my first thought is, how are we going to bring these lyrics to light when we are not able to sing?
Fascinating, right?
Right. And so it was all about, how do we create this mood? How do we create this intense, powerful message and take that and portray it as only instrumentalists? And so a lot of that has to go with thinking about the type of sound that you create. It goes with all the stage presence that you think about as a musician and how you approach it. And then another thing that we actually did is before we performed it, we actually read one of the verses or the chorus of the song to give people this context. And I think that was really powerful. How can you be true to the track and get across the intensely powerful message? And how do you make it your own?
We're speaking with Emma Kondo Powell and Kiyoshi Hayashi, who are both artists with the Rasa String Quartet. So, you know, we've touched on this a little bit with the conversation about Rhiannon Giddens' song. What has been echoing in our heads in preparing to have this conversation with you is a conversation we had recently about Indigenous art. In the Cape Ann region, an effort that's being done in Gloucester over the 400-year observation of the settling of English colonial settlers. And here is a quote by Steve Peters, the creative director of the organization Smoke Signals, which is a Wampanoag curatorial firm.
Where do these objects and these belongings truly, should they reside? Should they go back to the tribes where they came from? We think they should. We think the museums themselves are starting to understand that. They're starting to understand that they can't necessarily control the voice and the history the way that it had been told.
So it's fascinating when you think about music, which is shared in a way that maybe some other kinds of artifacts aren't. But how do you, and again, we've touched on this a little bit, how do you think about the stewardship of tradition and original ownership in folk music as you bring it forward? Because I think arguably maybe it's also an artifact.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, I definitely feel a lot of sort of personal responsibility to both do the research into understanding the music that we're performing ourselves, And I think one thing that we really sort of prioritize in our programming and concert experience is that we're always talking to the audience before we play any piece of music. So we're sort of hoping to share the stories that go along with the pieces of music that we play, so the audience can sort of get a bigger picture idea of what it is that we're trying to share. And yeah, for us to sort of be an amplifier of those voices, hopefully. And we, yeah, just hope to do it with the knowledge and the research and the respect that we can.
Another thing that I'll add on to that is, what can you do to the best of your ability, knowing that you're giving it your all in terms of being true to the original craft and the original tradition? I think it's really important, as we've already talked about, of doing your research and then also like getting help from people who are experts in that type of music. If you do your due diligence, if you do your research and you approach it very intentionally, then you should be able to share this amazing music, even though you might not feel like you're a quote unquote expert in it, as long as you've done your due diligence.
Okay, so we'll do one more sort of Rasa String Quartet comparison here. To come full circle, you mentioned Pete Seeger earlier. Let's finish up with one last song. This is Appalachian musician Roscoe Holcomb performing the song Little Birdie, and happens to be on Pete Seeger's television show from the mid-1960s. You can kind of hear a fiddling influence in it, even though it's banjo. So what's going on in this song that you pick up on as a violinist?
The groove. Immediately is just like, I think that's actually the biggest thing that classical musicians struggle with, is how do you create this vibe, this groove that folk musicians just have naturally.
Okay, and so now, well, Emma, let me ask you, as a violist, what's the first thing that you pick up on hearing that banjo play?
I would say I also sort of gravitate towards the groove of a piece first, but also, of course, the vocal line on top, which would generally probably go to the violinist in a classical setting.
You know, every time I hear a folk piece now, I'm going to think of the voice as a violin, and that's going to totally throw me off in a cool way. All right, so let's hear your version. String octet this time, Rasa String Quartet, along with Extet playing Little Birdie. Kiyoshi Hayashi, founder and violinist, and Emma Kondo Powell, violist, with the Boston-based Rasa String Quartet. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.